This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, generals behaving badly. How the Petraeus affair has dominated post-election Washington. It came up early in President Obama's Wednesday news conference.
By his own assessment, he did not meet the standards that he felt were necessary as the director of CIA.
Also, the Supreme Court takes up the Voting Rights Act. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Publishers Weekly picks the 10 best American essays since 1950. How do you think they did? Also, 007 is back in a huge way.
Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
Is Skyfall really a better Bond or just an expensive ad for martinis and sports cars? And finally, we'll explore a peculiar Thanksgiving alternative, the veggie duckin. It all starts with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Joining me from New Haven are Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
And a special guest this week, Atlantic senior editor Ta-Nehisi Coates. Hello, Ta-Nehisi.
Hi, David.
So I realize this doesn't reflect well on me, and you guys can disagree, but I find myself totally enjoying this ludicrous pinwheeling scandal that's happening on Petraeus. So I am looking forward to discussing every ludicrous detail with you, every confirmation that Florida is indeed the weirdest state in the union. So let's make that our first topic. Is that all right?
Sure.
We are going to.
Isn't it just like Real Housewives for nerds?
It's Real Housewives, not for nerds, it's Real Housewives
for
the Pentagon.
Nerds. Right, okay, for the Pentagon.
So we'll talk about that as topic one. Our second topic will be Emily will give us a brilliant disquisition on the Voting Rights Act case that the Supreme Court has taken up. Washington, recovering from the election, was gripped by a tragicomic scandal this week. It has destroyed the reputation and career of General and former CIA Director David Petraeus. It has ensnared another top general, John Allen, and it has generally embarrassed everyone involved with it. Every detail of the scandal is more ridiculous than the next one. The previously anonymous, now named shirtless FBI agent slash whistleblower, the biographer who got way too close to her subject and also did way too many push-ups, the would-be Tampa socialite Jill Kelly, debt-ridden, self-important, and histrionic, who set off this whole bizarre chain of events by passing on these anonymous emails that she had received. There are allegations that Democrats are covering up the scandal or covering up a scandal, or they covered up this scandal to ensure President Obama's reelection, or perhaps they are doing a cover up as part of some Benghazi conspiracy. There are allegations that the Republican FBI agent who blew the whistle on this and Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, are themselves interfering with the FBI, that they are politicizing the investigation, that they turned a private tawdry affair into a national scandal just to score political points. Emily, is there any kind of scandal here? And if so, if there is a scandal, is the scandal the behavior of the generals, or is it the way that the scandal has actually unfolded and the way it's been investigated?
The scandal that is troubling me is why the FBI launched this investigation. This is the part that gets me. So Jill Kelly, who's this like hanger-on socialite military person, gets a half dozen anonymous emails. They don't sound threatening. The media, we keep calling them harassing, but it doesn't actually seem to me, based on what we know of the content, that they qualify as anything like harassment. They were something like, stay away from that man, and I saw you touching him under the table. She doesn't like these emails. She gives them to this FBI agent friend of hers, Mr. Shirtless FBI, and he gets really excited about them and forwards them up the food chain to the cybercrimes unit at the FBI. I just cannot imagine, if she hadn't had this close personal relationship with an FBI agent, that anyone would have taken these emails seriously. And I say that because in my reporting on cyberbullying, one of the big issues is that the police in any decent-sized city have better things to do than look into emails unless they're explicitly and specifically threatening and then scary. And so the notion that this is what the FBI is for is really troubling to me. And everything stems from that initial decision. Everything else they found, like, yes, it's not good if classified material is not being handled properly. That was, you know, Thursday's wrinkle in the story. But that original call by the FBI has ruined one general, is on the way to messing up General Allen's career. And I just really wonder about the privacy implications of this.
Well, Ta-Nehisi, the FBI, having discovered this, and perhaps they've investigated this, they should investigate something they shouldn't have investigated, but having discovered what was going on, is it right and proper for what then unfolded to unfold, that you have David Petraeus going down?
Right, right. That's my big question that I would put. I definitely agree with Emily in terms of, you know, it seems like if you are an FBI agent, you should have better things to do than, you know, litigating, which just seems like a private dispute. It doesn't seem threatening at all. At the same time, I think, and some of us, you know, and I guess I fall into that category, being a little upset about how we deal with sexuality and how we deal with the fact of affairs in marriages, it seems like there's still a real practical problem, and that is that if you are having an affair and you are the head of the CIA, you can be blackmailed. Like, that seems like an actual real issue, even acknowledging that it was wrong how we got there. I don't know if that's fair, you know, especially to General Petraeus. I don't know if the means by which we got there are correct or right, but the ends seem about right. And also, I'm trying to figure out how does the and maybe you guys can explain this to me. How does the conspiracy that this helps Obama work? Is Holder like collaborating with the Republican FBI agent, or what are the lines of the conspiracy? What's the, you know, how does this work?
I think there are two elements, two ways it helps Obama. One is they delayed the scandal till after the election, and had this come out before the election, it just looks ugly, looks terrible. This person who's integral to your administration is involved in a sex scandal, and that's bad, and generally derails you and distracts people.
So do you think it would have?
Yes.
If Petraeus, you think it would have hurt Obama?
I think it would have hurt Obama a little bit. It wouldn't hurt him the way it would hurt him if it was Joe Biden.
And the Republicans wouldn't have gone after him, right?
I guess that's the thing. So what are they, like, how do they go after, like, how does that turn? I guess I'm trying to figure out how that turns to anybody's advantage.
Well, they would have argued that it was chaotic, that Obama can't manage his own shop.
Because Petraeus had an affair.
Well, because Petraeus was the head of the CIA and could have been blackmailed. They would have made the argument you just made, right? I mean, it would have been hard for them because, yes, Petraeus was a Bush appointee, and they do like him.
Well, there's also a kind of a Benghazi aspect of this, and this one is going to, like, confuse the heck out of you if you haven't read this. I've read about it, like, four different times, and I'm still confused. But basically, the theory is that the whole Benghazi mission was a CIA operation. The reason we had people in Benghazi to begin with was because the CIA were there, right? Not because the State Department wanted people there, but because the CIA wanted people there to spy. And so when Benghazi blew up and all those people were killed, basically what was happening was the CIA operation was getting disrupted. And the CIA were the ones that asked the State Department essentially to cover up what had happened. That's one theory.
To say it was a protest instead of Al-Qaeda, to
play defense on it a little bit while the CIA got itself in order. And the idea is that either the Obama administration itself took down Petraeus because he was going to refuse to lie on their behalf, or alternatively, that the Republicans took down Petraeus so that he couldn't then vouch for the CIA part of the story, and it would look like that it was just a State Department screw up and Susan Rice was lying on purpose. I mean, it's all totally confusing. I don't believe any of it. But there, if you're conspiratorial-minded enough, it is odd that there's the coincidence of Benghazi with this and the election all at once. And so people come up with crazy stuff. Emily, why do you think people get entranced with these sex scandals? Or is it just me that gets entranced with them?
I think it might be just you. Someone in Slate wrote convincingly this week about how little sex was in this sex scandal. I feel like it's the sex scandal for political observers like us who are stuck being obsessed with the news. So this is the closest we get to Us Weekly and People Magazine, like a little bit salacious details about Paul Broadwell. At least she has like super toned arms. That's something. That's more eye candy than we usually get in our weekly news diet, unless we're cheating on substance. And maybe that's why we're having such a good time with this. When, you know, in fact, there, it, I mean, also look, we have to say there is a really sad element element to this, because however ridiculous and cartoonish Jill Kelly and Paula Broadwell and General Petraeus and John Allen have made themselves, they have families who've been just humiliated.
Yeah, I think also, too, isn't this just a classic? I mean, for whatever reason, we take people and, to be totally cliche, we put them on a pedestal. But beyond that, Petraeus is this sort of scholar, warrior, you know, this intellectual sort of Buddhist monk, academic, you know, like he had a certain thing. I guess he's not a monk, right? Yeah. What I'm trying to say is that there was a mythology about him that, you know, he was like an ultimate warrior. You know, he was intelligent, you know, had the military aspect, all of that, everything you would want out of a soldier. And yet he has this great, ultimately human vulnerability. And I guess we don't expect people like that to ultimately have human vulnerabilities. That's what I was trying to say.
I find it so biblical. Like it's highly biblical, and there are these great, you know, the David and Bathsheba story has these military overtones, but there's something about military men and sexual behavior that always evokes ancient history to me and evokes old codes.
And in fact, there's an article called, I think, The Myth of Bathsheba or The Problem of Bathsheba that goes around in military circles when they're talking about infidelity. There's a great piece in Slate this week by Allison Buchholz that talks about that.
Oh, really? What's the story?
Now you've asked me for
this.
It's like my inch deep of knowledge on this. But I was really interested that it was called that. And Allison was talking more broadly about how infidelity is something that military families have to talk about because of these extended periods of being away from each other. And sometimes wives are asked to put up with what she calls like the distinction between the home team, your American family, and the away team, which is your family abroad, like your husband's second family.
Although the weird thing about this and that in the way that it reverses the Bathsheba story is that, of course, that in the Bathsheba story, it's the husband who goes off to war so that the David can be with the wife, but in this case, it's the wife who goes off to war while the husband stays behind. It's
for the Paula Broadwell.
Paula Broadwell is the one who goes off to Afghanistan, puts herself in danger with David Petraeus, with the David in the story, and the husband is at home on the home front.
Isn't just to push this a little bit more? Isn't it the idea that we see Petraeus as a man with a code?
Right.
Isn't that the essential difference? Like, I mean, a lot and codes are something that, you know, I think we look back like longingly and wistfully on in this age of, you know, individualism, do whatever you want. And he wasn't supposed to be that. He was supposed to be a man with a code. And this is a serious violation of what that code
right,
was.
Right. When you look at Bill Clinton, you know this is an unprincipled lecher, right?
Right.
That was fine. And it was okay.
There were rumors about him forever.
Right, right. Exactly. Exactly.
Almost men of every stripe and women of every stripe apparently are willing to cheat on their marriages for whatever reasons they do it. And we should be beyond surprise. And we shouldn't assume that because he cheated in this aspect of his life, he therefore cheated in every other aspect of his life.
Right, right.
Right. Well, that's the argument that perhaps resigning wasn't necessary and that we're losing someone who was, at least right. by some accounts, really good at his job for very little reason.
Right.
One last point I want to get into because it's the other aspect of this which I find enthralling. Why is Florida always the ground zero for these for weird scandals and crimes? Why, whenever you hear about, you know, somebody, the guy who chews off someone else's face, or the chimpanzee that escapes and mauls 27 people, or whatever it is, it's always in Florida.
I don't know. Really? Do you think it really is crazier in Florida?
I definitely think it's crazier in Florida. Also, it's like Florida is one of these places where it's so many different kinds of people are butting up against each other.
Not New York.
I don't know. In New York, there's some of that in New York. But I guess I feel that cities are orderly. Actually, even though cities appear to be disorderly, in fact, cities are very orderly. But cities have very... particularly the modern, well-policed city has pretty clear sets of rules because people are butting up against each other. They know to behave in certain ways. Whereas a place that's as big, as expansive, and as wild as Florida is much less regulated.
Right. Well, just to go with you for a second, like there was that great George Packer piece in The New Yorker where he talked about how it was basically an ever-reproducing frontier. because there's just so much land and so much house. So I wonder if the openness that you're describing.
And that piece was about forfeiture, right? And
right,
all
yeah,
the bankruptcies
yeah,
and mortgage
right,
foreclosures
right,
going on.
Right.
Right. It's also a place where people have gone in the way they've gone to California for a dream.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a dream that, you know, I guess this is also true of California. The dream doesn't come true all the time. And when it does, right, your dreams don't come true, you buy an alligator and start feeding babies to it or something.
You go to one of Jill Kelly's parties.
All right. Coming up, the Supreme Court revisits voting rights. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and Ta-Nehisi Coates. And this is the political GabFest portion of the show. The Supreme Court announced last week it would hear an Alabama county's challenge to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Emily, just tell us what the Voting Rights Act is. What is Section 5? What's the big deal about this particular legal challenge?
The Voting Rights Act is one of the crown jewels of the civil rights movement. It was passed in 1965. It has two parts to it. Section 5 is the part that looked at the country in 1965, looked at where there was evidence that states and cities were systematically discriminating against black people, and said that those parts of the country, mostly the Deep South, if they wanted to make any change at all to the way they ran their elections, they would have to get the go-ahead first from the Department of Justice. They don't get the benefit of the doubt when they are changing their election laws. The other part of the law, Section 2, gives the Justice Department and private citizens a right to sue if they think that something has been discriminatory in the way an election law has been changed. So it's, and that applies to the whole country. The other kind of piece of background that's important for this is that Congress renewed the Voting Rights Act in the 80s and then again in 2006 and chose not to change the way it's constructed, even though when you think about the way the country looks now, the particular pattern of discrimination from 1965 is now not a particularly good fit for the way the country actually operates. So, for example, Florida just had a total mess of an election. Maybe because of racial discrimination, maybe not. It doesn't matter. They don't have to pre-clear anything with justice. They're not covered by Section 5. So that's one issue. And then a second concern is that in 2009, the Supreme Court took another challenge to Section 5, and they basically ducked. But they kind of said, you know what? We're not really, this conservatives on the court, we're not really feeling so great about the constitutionality of this law. Hey, Congress, you might want to take another look, make some more solid factual findings, change it. And Congress didn't do anything. So that's another reason why it looks like for the court to have taken another case implies that they are ready to topple Section 5, half of essentially, you know, a big chunk of the Voting Rights Act.
Assuming the Supreme Court knocks down Section 5, what does Alabama then look like?
So that's a really good question. I was actually someone, a law professor named Rick Pildes, who actually really studies this stuff, that question yesterday. And so in some ways we don't know, right? Because Alabama looks the way it does now because it's had Section 5 all these years, or at least perhaps. And if we don't have any more Section 5, we'll still have Section 2. And so if Alabama did something that seemed overtly or, it, you know, had it what's called disparate impact, like had the effect of racial discrimination, DOJ or someone could sue over it. And in that sense, it doesn't seem as if, you know, Section 5, it's certainly not the only answer that federal law or the Voting Rights Act itself provides to these situations. But we would be losing this kind of shield that clearance from the Justice Department has provided for all these years.
But what about all those places outside of the shield of the Justice Department? I mean, it seems to me that we have an election, we have a voting crisis in this country, but it's not really a racial voting crisis. We have a partisan voting crisis, of which the racial part of it is sort of a subcomponent because African Americans and Hispanics are so strongly identified with the Democratic Party that it becomes racial. But basically, we have a partisan war.
Yeah, I disagree, David.
Over, bring it. That's fine. That's
yeah,
what we're here
hear.
For.
We want to hear. Because David's position, just to add to this, is one shared by a lot of people who actually study this. Not that, you know, racial discrimination is over, but that we would be better off if you were writing the Voting Rights Act now or a voting law, you would make it uniform. And the evidence for that is that we had Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Missouri pass these, you know, wrong-headed voter ID laws this year. None of them are covered, didn't have to pre-clear. Right. Why should that go on when, you know, Texas and North Carolina had to, or South Carolina had to strike down their laws?
Or they,
right, I just wanted challenge the chicken or the egg thing, i.e. does the hostility to party come before hostility to race or the other way around? And I actually think that a significant part of this is racial hostility. I think that there is a very, very long history of doubting who should exercise citizenship rights, particularly around the right to vote. I don't think that's particularly dissipated. I'm not saying the way we're doing things now is the best way to do things, but I don't think it's merely a matter of trying to deprive Democrats the right to vote. When people make the claim, for instance, that we saw today that in Maine, hundreds of black people appeared out of nowhere and voted illegally, I don't think that's merely a hostility towards the Democratic Party. I would go so far as to say, even when you hear Romney talking about giving people stuff, as though Mitt Romney would not have given all those millionaires stuff, I think that's about a kind of hostility that goes beyond merely party.
Right. We talked about this with the welfare to work ad that Romney ran. And so this is, to me, the crux of it. It's a matter of timing, right? You know, you can imagine a better world of a better America, a post-racial America. you can imagine that world, but Congress in 2006 didn't think we were in that world yet. So is it the Supreme Court's job 6 years later to say, you know what, we've arrived, even though Congress said 6 years ago, this is the regime we want in place for the next 25 years?
What, Emily, where, or Ta-Nehisi, where does the fact, the kind of weird detente between white Republicans and black Democrats in the South over congressional districts, where essentially they put a lot of black Democrats into, you know, into districts, which then lots of black and I suppose some white candidates won those districts. But it, what it did is it created sort of smaller Democratic presence in southern states in congressional districts, but it increased minority representation in Congress at the cost of, I think, driving out moderates in
right. Well, it basically racialized the parties, and it accelerated any level of racialization that was already there, was going to be there in the parties. I would push back just a little bit on the notion of it being detente. I mean, it's certainly detente for somebody who wants a safe congressional seat and wants to make it their life. But I think if you are an African-American and have some desire of running statewide in the South, it's a bad, bad deal. And you would gladly part you know, with that, because it basically means that your power base is only going to be a majority African-American power base. You have no ability to have any sort of, we have limited ability, I should say, to have a power base that's large. So if you think about trying to one day imagine an African-American running statewide in a state like Georgia, it makes it really, really hard for anybody with ambitions beyond, you know, running for Congress.
Right. Harold Ford came very close
in
Tennessee. I mean, Harold Ford came as close as you can. I mean, it's a relatively sort of a border state. And Harold's moved out of Tennessee.
Right.
Emily, do you think there's ever going to be a big piece of federal civil rights legislation again?
No, I don't. Mm. But I do think that the one or a, I mean, this is a little bit dreamy, but you imagine that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act going down. The right response to that from Congress would be to pass some really strong uniform voting protection everyone has a right to access and to have their vote counted, and then to do something about gerrymandering, to set some kind of standard for constraining it. And that we don't necessarily have – this isn't a domain.
No, you're so
even
funny,
if,
Emily.
I like to dream. Come on. I mean, that's not impossible. It's so crazy what was happening in Florida and Ohio. How can anyone think that is like a well-run system
Florida,
that we should be proud of?
It's an absolute disgrace. And I'm just going to endorse these shoot for the sky sort of solutions. They have to be out there.
They really
have to be out there. You know, they may not come true for another 50 years.
We passed what's it called? HAVA, H-A-V-A, the one that makes it easier to register to vote when you get your driver's license. Mm-hmm. That's a uniform federal law about voting.
I think it's okay to shoot for the sky if the sky has walked into your bedroom. Then you can shoot for the sky. That'll do it for the political GabFest portion of the show. I'm David Plotz in Washington, handing the show off to Stephen in New York.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture GabFest. On today's program, the new and so far madly beloved James Bond movie Skyfall, and then we look at an intriguing list, the top 10 essays since 1950. And finally, Yes, it's true, the veggie duckin, with our producer, Dan Pashman, who's also the host of the wonderful podcast, The Sporkful. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And finally back is Dana Stevens, our film critic, Slate's film critic. Hey, Dana.
Hey, yes, acts of God kept me away an extra week, but I'm glad to be back.
Force majeure.
Peut-être.
All right. Anyway, Skyfall is the 23rd installment in the James Bond franchise. It made something close to $90 million this past weekend. It is getting a 91 rating or something like that on Rotten Tomatoes. You didn't even need to look at Rotten Tomatoes. It's ambient, the love people are feeling for this movie. It supposedly is going to revive the franchise for another 50 years, which the movie itself winks at in its own storyline. It stars, of course, Daniel Craig returning as James Bond for the third time, along with Judi Dench as M, and Ray Fiennes as a bureaucrat with a heart of adventure, it turns out. Before we get lost in our discussion, let's listen to a clip from the film.
007, I'm your new quartermaster.
You must be joking.
Age is no guarantee of efficiency.
And youth is no guarantee of innovation.
I'll hazard I can do more damage on my laptop sitting in my pajamas before my first cup of Earl Grey than you can do in a year in the field.
Oh, so why do you need me?
Every now and then a trigger has to be pulled.
Or not pulled. It's hard to know which in your pajamas.
Dan, this movie is being crushed upon publicly and repeatedly. I'm really curious. What do you think of it? And what do you think of the Bond franchise in general? I've never heard you expound on it.
It's true. We have never talked about Bond on this show, which is odd because we've existed since the Craig era began. You know, I can understand why this is a very popular movie and why people are liking it. I guess I don't quite get why it revives the franchise for another 50 years. If anything, it feels to me like a valedictory sort of Bond film. It seems like it's about the exhaustion of the character, the exhaustion of many of the tropes, and that's what makes some of it interesting, that it's a sad and dark and somber Bond movie. But it also seems to me like I'm not sure where the character has to go from here.
Mm-hmm. Did I mention, Julia, the most important thing is that this was directed by Sam Mendes, who probably is still best known to American movie-going audiences who care about directors for American Beauty. He also did Revolutionary Road, which starred his then-wife, Kate Winslet, along with Leonardo DiCaprio. I mean, it's, you know, he was a theater director in London before he became a Hollywood director. He's a director with serious pretensions. He clearly wanted to make this movie a good movie. What'd you make of it?
I thought it was pretty great. I mean, I think it was my favorite of the Daniel Craig Bond movies. It seemed to have a bit more fun with the franchise than the first one did. And I think in large part it's great because of the terrific performance of the villain, who's played by Javier Bardem as sort of this menacing psychopath, and who's just, I think, one of the best Bond villains of all time. He just rolls around in the role in a really extravagant way that pairs nicely with Daniel Craig's pretty straight and clenched performance as Bond, I think. I find Daniel Craig to be a slightly clenched Bond, and mm-hmm. I think the looseness of some of the other characters in this, both Javier Bardem's villain and Ben Whishaw's Q gadget freak, lightened up the movie for me.
I thought Bardem was terrific, but Dana, did you have a little queasiness about what I loved about his performance? Is A, he's a terrific actor. He's done up beautifully. He's given a backstory. His desire is not some generic megalomaniacal desire to control the world or abolish it in, you know, a nuclear holocaust. He's not, you know, this is post Austin Powers Bond. You have to go someplace else. They definitely did with this character. He's portrayed both in the script and by Bardem as either gay or bi. You know, he makes kind of a half advance on James Bond, which is on Daniel Craig slash James Bond, which is responded to in a real, I won't give it away, but in a truly classic and suggestive, wonderfully suggestive way. Nonetheless, I wasn't sure how enlightened this portrayal of the villain was as gay. I would love to think we're at a moment in the history of gay rights that we could have a villain who happened to be gay, and it was as incidental as him happening to be 5'10" or 6'3" or whatever. Did you feel that way? And also, what do you make of the idea that this is somehow a feminist James Bond movie?
Okay. Well, to the first, I don't think I loved Javier Bardem or the villain he plays as much as you guys did. He seemed a little bit – I mean, I love Bardem. I love that he was sinking his teeth into it, and he looked fabulous. But It seemed to me a generic, off the shelf, a little bit Austin Powersy kind of villain, and he did seem to have sort of been piled up with meanie traits as opposed to, you know, given any rich backstory. He also doesn't get much of a chance to interact with M, who is the character, Judy Dench's character, that he has this huge grudge against, which is the whole reason he's pursuing this world domination plan, and they only get one scene together. You know, I was not offended by the scene in which he deploys his gayness, or perhaps sort of assumed gayness, in order to make Bond uncomfortable. It didn't seem to me like a homophobic scene, but maybe that's my straight viewership that's not able to take offense at that. I do think that all these pieces I'm seeing right and left about how this is the most feminist Bond movie ever are complete bullshit. I mean, come on. This movie is deeply misogynistic in the way that every Bond movie has been. And without spoiling it, I can't really get into the fate of the character Severine, the slinky gangster's moll played by Bernice Marlowe. But what happens to her, her character trajectory is just disgusting.
Yeah, but are we really going to have a conversation in which we lament the lack of a quote-unquote enlightened Bond villain, Steve, and we take seriously the gender politics of the film? I mean, this is going to make me sound totally retrograde, but I feel like part of the Bond fantasy is that it lives in a world apart from and distinct from gender and sexual politics. And in fact, that's part of what the fantasy is, I think, for some of the people who are obsessed with Bond and love Bond. And then I think if you're a modern feminist viewer, you just have to either like jump on that train and enjoy the fact that it is no longer the prevailing winds of our time, or ignore it. I mean, I'm not sure I need Bond and Bondette mm-hmm. as equal partners in crime fighting.
Yeah. I think during the unfurling of the movie, I feel the same way. But then I don't want to go home and read some feminist blogger talk about what a fabulously feminist mm-hmm. movie this is because Judy Dench plays someone awesome.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one, Dana. Julia, also, I think you're really getting at what makes James Bond movies so hard to judge as either good or bad, right? Because what makes them good is that they're comforting and repetitive and ritualistic and therefore familiar, right? They can only play off of their own nostalgia in a way. So they tend to be airless museum pieces from the beginning, right? Or they tend to be kitsch, winky kitsch, right? It's very hard for these movies to be productive of either originality or suspense. And in that way, I'm just surprised at how much people – I think it's quite good, but good where good means competent, almost unbelievably competent, like very extremely well crafted and made, but not really exciting.
Well, I also think there's just not the Bond world, the Bond universe is so hermetic. I don't think it can comment on anything or interact with any idea apart from itself anymore. So even there were a few notions and flourishes in the film, and I don't know if they came from Mendes wanting to make a smarter film or what, of, you know, what does it mean to be a spy in this time, and do we no longer need spies because it's post-Cold War, I don't know what. And at one point, Judy Dench's M makes an impassioned speech to a parliamentary committee in which she says, you know, now that we don't know who our enemies are, we need spies and cloaks and daggers more than ever. And all of that just falls totally flat. I mean, I'm not – these movies are not prisms that allow us to refract our time and see anything interesting about it. And maybe that's too lofty a claim to make for any action movie, but I think you could argue that the Bourne movies perhaps, or some other action movies we've seen in the past few years, can do that and can interact with the moment in a particular way. But the point of Bond is that it is its own universe, it is its own world, it is its own moment, and so you have to just enjoy it inside of itself. And this was a suspenseful movie with some great action scenes and some pretty ladies and a really fun villain and a kind of blockbuster finale sequence, and I liked it, and a good theme song. I mean, but I just don't I agree with you, Dana. Seeing people trying to read too much into the gender politics of it is not working for me.
The movie is Skyfall. It's the latest James Bond. It's doing huge business, and we all basically liked it, Dana, a little less than me and Julia. But go check it out. Coming up, the strange new Thanksgiving beast known as the Vegidekan. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. Robert Atwan, who is the founder of the Best American Essay series that people I'm sure see all over this country in independent bookstores, out on tables, comes out once a year, has recently picked...
I think they even carry it in evil corporate bookstores.
No, I don't think they do. No. He recently picked the 10 best essays of the post-war period going back roughly 50 years. And we decided to pick over the list, select a couple, and talk about them and the essay as a form and whence and whither. And Julia, what leapt out at you? Which one what did you end up reading, and what did you make of it? And as an editor, what do you think about the state of this kind of writing?
Yeah, it was interesting reading Atwan's essay, and we should mention that his essay appeared in Publishers Weekly, and there's a list with links to all of the essays there, about why he chose these 10 essays, what he thought made them great, and what makes the essay great as a form, was a really interesting read for me as an editor, because it made me realize that you don't see this exact form as much anymore as I think you might have in the past. It doesn't seem to appear as often, and I think there are a couple interesting reasons for why that might be. I mean, I read James Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son, and it's a beautiful piece of writing and an incredible essay that seems to crystallize and encapsulate something about the experience of a young black man in the 1940s during World War II. And there's a way in which his essay takes his personal experience and uses it to universalize about the common human experience, the American experience, the experience of black Americans, that I think is an instinct we avoid these days. I think the notion of taking one's own personal experience of the world and trying to draw larger conclusions from it about what other people's experiences might be is something that we're less comfortable with as a culture 60 years after that essay was written, and that you don't see people doing that in quite the same way.
And yet there's so much confessional and personal writing that seems like it directly springs from this tradition. So I completely agree with you, Julia, that reading these, I thought, wow, nobody writes like this anymore. Nobody writes in this form anymore. And yet we're drowning in all kinds of personal, confessional, autobiographical blog posts and essays and memoirs. And I'm just curious, what's different? What's changed?
Yeah, I mean, look, change is the inevitable thing. One is, you know, takes away from looking at these as a group, right? So I read or had recently read the Baldwin, which is very much about race relations, you know, prior to desegregation, right? Then there's The White Negro by Mailer, which is about race relations from a white writer's point of view. Later in the 50s, kind of not only, you know, kind of around Brown, I think it's after Brown v. Board, but very much in that moment when the hipster is coming to, you know, the beat and the hipster are becoming, you know, culturally available models for white behavior, you know, patterned on a black jazz musician, right? So the sort of, but the big subject of it, I mean, he opens, the opening line of the Mailer essay is that we all of us live, you know, semi-consciously in the shadow of the atomic bomb and the Holocaust, basically. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, it opens with the largest conceivable gambit, right? And it's a totally universal statement, and it's a universal statement that happens to be true, right? And then I read Didion's The White Album, which is about how generally a feeling of paranoia had seeped into every cranny of the culture, and it's about how her own personal experience of nervous breakdown completely mimics and echoes the national experience of nervous breakdown in the 60s, and how far that's going to go, both with her. Like, how totally is she going to blow apart, and how totally is the country going to blow apart? And then you get to David Foster Wallace, right? An essay written in the 90s, you know, Wallace has been...
Consider the Lobster is the one that he lists.
Yeah, Consider the Lobster is the one that's included. And all of a sudden, it's very hard to say. It's like, well, what large question of American identity is even available to Wallace? I don't mean to rag on him. In many ways, it is an extraordinary piece of writing. But there is a way in which both he and Franzen, his other great contemporary, have had to make incredible lemonade, right? They've had to work with lemons so hard in order to get half potable lemonade, right? They're dealing with the small and the diminished, and it's as if people have, they have no means of egress through themselves to something large anymore via this medium, I think, looking at these. Now, I may be completely wrong, to the point that it's a joke in Girls that she's an essayist. I love that. It's one of the great observations of that show. She keeps saying she's an essayist. And we're meant to, exactly the way we're meant to take that character as both things, as both a kind of wonderfully self-aware and a pathetically self-unaware human being at the same time. That's the way we're supposed to take that statement, right? Like, it's so self-important and deluded and small in a way. And that's sort of sad.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's something, I mean, Steve, you seem to suggest that the nicheification of the culture has left modern essayists with less to deal with. I'm not sure I think that's true. I think if you read, I actually think the wrong David Foster Wallace essay was included here, and that if you read A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, which is his masterpiece essay about cruise ships, you do learn something. He does take a stab at saying something larger about American pastimes and our preoccupation with death. And
I think the Lobster essay does that as well, and I will not be party to the David Foster Wallace bashing. Well, I think also when you read some of these essays, like the Male or White Negro essay, they're very bombastic and dated, and some of that, you know, ability to claim, hey, the Holocaust and nuclear weapons and then my experience at a party are, you know, in some way equivalent subjects of this essay. It is something that's harder to get away with now. And in some ways, that's a good thing. I think that maybe the experience of the other is something that has to be taken into account when picking up your pen in a way that Mailer didn't have to do.
And yet, at the end of the day, I prefer the Mailer. I think that that's a really enduring essay. And I think he got at something about what the relations – I mean, when you read that essay knowing what came next – that essay is written before the 60s unfolds as a work. I mean, the mode is prophecy, right? And you can say, oh, I don't want some, you know, alcoholic gas bag telling me how to think. At the same time, if he tells you what the next 20 years of American life are going to be, under what terms they're going to unfold, under what terms the culture wars 30 years later are going to unfold, like, the fact that he happens to be a Harvard-educated white male seems to me completely incidental. The authority is established by the substance of the argument.
And who knows? Perhaps somebody right now is going to write the great American essay about how the Petraeus scandal is hanging heavily over us for months, and we'll all learn more about our psyches from it.
I also wanted to shout out to one on this list that I don't think any of us read in preparation for this, but I have read long ago when I was really, really into Annie Dillard, and that's Annie Dillard's essay Total Eclipse, which is just about going with her husband to a place where they saw a total eclipse and the staying in the hotel room and what the experience was like sort of detail by detail. And it's an incredibly lyrical, beautiful piece of nonfiction writing, just an amazing essay.
She's an amazing writer.
All right. Well, it's the list is the 10 best essays since 1950. It's available on the Publishers Weekly website, and we'll link to it on our webpage. All right. Well, moving on, we're joined by our producer, Dan Pashman, who's also the host of a wonderful podcast called The Sporkful. Dan, it's so great to have you on the near side of the glass.
Thank you.
So it occurs to us that Thanksgiving is in its way to cuisine what the James Bond franchise is to cinema. That is to say that in one respect, it's repetitive. It's comforting for being repetitive. It's highly ritualistic. On the other hand, it trends towards airlessness, bordering on asphyxia. In order to enliven it and make it a little less trad, Dan is here to talk to us about something called the – what is it, Dan? Say the word.
The veggie duckin'.
All right. So – and I just – first of all, in order for people to understand exactly what the veggie duckin' is, people have to understand what a turducken is. So why don't we start there?
The turducken is a chicken inside a duck inside a turkey with stuffing between each layer. And you debone all of the two interior birds and almost all of the exterior turkey. So you can essentially slice it. And I've had it once in my life. It is a wondrous creation, although the one that I had a lot of sausage stuffing. And that gets into – in this week's Sporkful Thanksgiving episode, I talk with Slate's own Laura Anderson about the issue of stuffing. And it was actually my experience with the turducken that helped inform my opinion about stuffing, which is that the primary purpose of stuffing should be to absorb liquid, not to release it. And that was an issue I ran into with all the sausage stuffing and the grease. And then the, you know, duck is very fatty. And then that was just sort of too much. So that's the situation with the turducken. Yes, Dana.
What is the provenance of the turducken? It sounds like some medieval creation. Is it a recent chef's invention?
I think it's medieval to some extent, and I think that it sort of has made a comeback in recent years in the age of the internet and sort of absurdist food creations. I saw – this is how you can tell that Halloween and Thanksgiving are melding into one holiday. I saw a great costume online where you could buy a chicken costume, and if you buy it really tight, then you could put a – duck costume on top and then put a turkey costume on top of that, and then you would be a turducken for Halloween.
But you'd have to be sliced by your friends in order to be appreciated.
And
you'd
be very hot at the party.
And stuffed full of sausage. You have to make sure that you release and don't absorb. Anyway, did these meats actually enhance one another's flavor in any way, or is it just purely a novelty gesture?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I happen to be a huge fan of duck. Duck is my number two meat after pork. Those are the two meats that are kind of right in a sort of sweet spot between white meat and beef, if you will, that are still sort of readily accessible. And this is sort of the sweetness and the flavor. I love the fattiness of duck. Of course, what's the number one thing? What's the number one criticism you hear of a Thanksgiving turkey gone awry? Is that
dry?
Too dry.
Right. And so you stick a duck inside it.
All right. So moving on to the veggie duckin. So we sitting here at the Gabfest, we're punting around ideas for a third topic, and we get an email from you that just says veggie duckin, and all of us said done simultaneously. You know, you had us at veggie duckin. What's a veggie duckin?
Well, veggie duckin is something I came up with that's inspired by the turducken, but it's something for, you know, I'm not a vegetarian, but, you know, a lot of my best friends are. And I wanted them to have, you know, an awesome centerpiece dish. I mean, I know that there's a lot of great vegetarian food out there. I know that you can have a wonderful Thanksgiving dinner without eating turkey. But I love the event of it all. I love buying the turkey days in advance and planning how you're going to cook it. And I like to brine it starting a day or two in advance. And then you put it in the oven that morning. And you're in the kitchen all day, hopefully drinking and waiting for the turkey. And then it comes out and it cools and it's sliced and it's carved. And then this great moment where it gets unveiled as the centerpiece of the entire table.
Oh, Dan, why am I not invited to your house for Thanksgiving? I'm going to spend the whole day weeping now. Sorry. Imagining your joy.
I know. But the vegetarians don't have that. And I want
the centerpiece dish.
Right. And it's a dish that you don't make or wouldn't make except when you're having a big event and many people are coming.
Right. It's true. Most of the vegetable sides that are traditional to Thanksgiving are things that a vegetarian might eat any night of the week. Brussels sprouts with pecans in them or mashed sweet potatoes, or this is all just like daily lunch fare for the vegetarian.
Exactly.
It's not special occasion food.
Right. And I want them to have a special occasion food. And so that's
why. You're so generous.
Yes.
You're so kind.
I want them to feel my joy is all.
So, Dan, but you're bearing the lead. So what is stuffed inside of what is stuffed inside of what?
Okay. Well, I will explain it. I'll start from the exterior. It starts with a banana squash, which is pretty much the largest squash money can buy. It's about 2 feet long.
I don't know if I've ever seen a banana squash.
Yeah, well, I guess you haven't watched the Veggie Duckin video yet.
No.
But it's very large, and you can kind of hollow it out. And again, with a turducken, as with Veggie Duckin, there's stuffing between each layer. So you hollow out the banana squash, you lay down on one half of it, lay down stuffing, then leeks, then more stuffing, then two sweet potatoes, which have been peeled and partially cooked in the microwave, so they cook through. Then it's a symmetrical creation. So then comes stuffing, leeks, stuffing, and the top of the banana squash. And then you bake the whole thing in the oven for a while, and it slices up. It's 2 feet long. I mean, it will fill a giant carving board. But it also, because you can slice it up, it can also, one slice of veggie duckin can be a side dish for a carnivore. So everyone can enjoy it. But it is definitely eye-catching. I think that it could rival a turkey just in terms of glamour. Thanksgiving glamour on the table.
Why leeks?
Leeks, well, with something like the veggie duckin, there's a lot of structural concerns here in building something like this. And you need foods that are proportionally each bigger than the next and that can be maneuvered in such a way that they can expand outward and cut in such a way. And leeks, because you can kind of cut them into thin stalks, work in the middle because you can kind of it's not one leek as a whole. It's leek stalks. And so you can kind of move them around.
So it's kind of like a lay. It's like a thatching, a light thatching of leeks.
That's right. Yes, very much so. Because stuffing is sort of a mortar.
Right.
It's like stuffing is kind of the mud of your hut and the leeks are the thatching.
This is getting very architectural.
Yeah. It's also making vegetarianism sound so self-hating as to be unbelievable. I have thatch and mud, you know, and you have turkey.
But, Julia, there is a flavor reason, which is that, you know, most of the larger vegetables that you might want to – that would be seasonal to the Thanksgiving time that you might want to use to make a veggie duckin, a lot of them are kind of in the same family. You sort of have different kinds of potatoes and you have different kinds of squash.
Right, you wouldn't want to do a butternut squash in the middle
because
that would just be a sweet squash pile.
Exactly. And so I wanted something in there that was just going to be different from potatoes and squash.
Have a little bit of tang.
Have a little bit of tang, exactly. So it also provides a flavor contrast to the other ingredients.
Steve, what's your stuffing? Are you a vegetarian at Thanksgiving? I mean, you're a vegetarian.
I am a vegetarian at Thanksgiving, absolutely. Yeah, no.
So what is your sad poultry feast?
His principles are inviolate, except when the vegan is confronted with goat cheese.
Exactly, inviolably pristine.
So what is your sad meager plate consist of?
Just wasp passive aggression. Really, but a heaping portion.
I was going to say, you guys must have big plates.
Yeah.
Chargers. Full-on chargers.
Exactly. All right. Well, Dan, thank you so much for crawling out from behind the glass and joining us. That was really fun.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. So you can find a video about the veggie duckin and presumably discover how to make a veggie duckin at sporkful.com. All right. Well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
So in honor of our essay segment, I just wanted to endorse the ultimate Ur essay, the first essay to have used the term essay, which is Michel de Montaigne's On Friendship. All of Montaigne's essays are tremendously fun and rollicking and wonderful to read all these centuries later. But Of Friendship in particular is a great Michel de Montaigne starter piece. It's basically a lament for the loss of his best friend and a sort of using a lot of classical Roman quotes. He just sort of reflects on what friendship is and what this man has meant in his life. It's a really, really beautiful essay. And it's available all over the place online.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, it's truly one of the all-time classics. Julia, what do you have?
I also have an essay to endorse, and it's another classic that I think a lot of people have read. But it's Joan Didion's Goodbye to All That, which is an essay about leaving New York after having spent one's 20s there and the enchantment and captivation that one can feel initially upon living in New York and how that can come to seem tired and stale and exhausting and sad and drive people to leave at a certain age. And I remember reading it in my mid-20s and just being blown away by the exact thing we were talking about in that segment of how one woman's particular experience could seem so possibly universal and profound. Although not so profound that I left because I'm still here and I'm not going anywhere. But it's a really remarkable read.
Here, here. All right. Well, I'm going to endorse something that is sort of an essay, but it eventually took book form, which is Stephen Jay Gould, the paleontologist, has a very interesting reputational problem, which is that he became enormously prominent in the 70s and 80s as a popularizing science essayist. And the best thing that he wrote, he won the National Book Award for it, is a book called The Mismeasure of Man, which is about psychometric testing, intelligence, race, and genes. And then he updated it to include a chapter directly refuting the bell curve. And I've actually written a little bit about the relationship between group differences in IQ, specifically between blacks and whites. It's a terrifying subject. People are afraid of it. And one of the smartest people I interviewed about it was a scientist who studies it from the point of view of science and social science with numerical rigor. And he says people don't like this subject because they're so afraid it's going to turn out to be true, that certain liberal pieties are going to be refuted by the science. And he says, in fact, they're not. And Stephen Jay Gould was one of the primary scientists who went in and looked at the data and said, there's nothing to be afraid of here. These people are throwing dust in our eyes. And that book aggregates many of those arguments and goes back very rigorously over the entire history of a really sad kind of quasi-eugenic streak in the American character. And it's a remarkable book. It's called The Mismeasure of Man. All right. Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest, and you'll find the longer podcast version of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Wolo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week.